Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Oh, hello. It's Thursday, and it's time to welcome you to Waypoints, where the Waypoint staff and friends take a break to nerd out and deep dive on the culture, art, and entertainment that's been inspiring and provoking us lately. Gathered around the table this Thursday, we've got Patrick Klepek.
Hello.
Danielle Riendo.
I am both inspired and provoked.
Austin Walker, can you match that?
No.
All right. Well, that was Austin Walker, everybody.
Have a good one, say everybody. Goodbye. Have a good one. I'm going to go back on vacation, I think. Yeah. Maybe. I'll just, until I'm inspired and provoked again.
Yeah, sure.
Can we make them bigger, Kato?
No.
I mean, I can.
I mean, I'm on like, Twitter.
I can make threat displays if that helps.
What do we mean by just,
so, no is the answer. The answer is no, you
get
can't.
Get that wingspan.
Bigger. You know? Can you make it so that Rob's face isn't literally blocked by. Can you swap the two?
What about that?
That's great. That's fantastic. Yeah. I can see them all now.
There you go. There you go.
Thank you. Oh, yeah, the recording spider is
There was a giant, there's a giant spider made of metal in this room now, and it was blocking Rob's. This is why I wasn't inspired or provoked, because I couldn't be, because I couldn't see Rob's face, my muse.
What's the evil spider's face that Natalie was scared of during that Bloodborne stream?
It's the spider
with the white face and the red lips.
I remember, but
Kato, you found a beautiful image for it?
It's fine.
That's like, just spiders. Spiders are bullshit. Like, why do you have to find a specific one?
Any of them. Not a fan. I like tarantulas.
I respect them. I allow the daddy long legs to do their business.
Yeah, go
their
have
dark
fun.
Business in the corners of my house.
Their dark
I do not kill
business.
Them. Yeah, they're eating the bugs.
They're eating the bugs.
Nature is doing things for me. I just don't want to see it. You stay up in that corner, out of sight. Occasionally, my daughter will go, "I see a spider," and I was like, "You better be fucking lying to me, kid." She usually is.
Spider threats.
She doesn't know, or she sees really small ones.
I have
she's a
been
baby.
Provoked.
There it is. Provoked Patrick Klepek.
Now we need to inspire him.
It's your name in Metal Gear Solid 5. Provoked Patrick Klepek.
David Hayter to record
it's Thursday.
A voicemail.
It's time to welcome you to Waypoints. So what we're going to lead off with here is a graphic essay by Nate Powell, who was the artist on the comic series March. Covering John Lewis's life and the events leading up to the, Selma March, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But this is an essay called About Face, Death and Surrender in the Clothing of Men, which talks about sort of the paramilitary aesthetic that has made its way from the armed forces in the era of the global war on terror and has started to become, kind of the fashion statement of a nascent fascist movement is Powell's ultimate argument. And this was getting passed around last week, partly in the wake of another ad that came to people's attention that was put out. It's an old ad, but it sort of became front of mind last week because people, I think, finally started noticing it and passing it around. An ad from the brand Grunt Style, which shows a... How can something this sentimental also be this fucking scary? It's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. There was this ad getting passed around Twitter. You may have seen it. It's a cop being threatened by Antifa. Just
so
people,
terrifying.
You know,
good Lord.
Just all these kids, like some of them are like disrespecting the flag. Some of them are holding signs calling police fascists.
No justice, no peace, no police is what one of the signs says.
And a ethnically, ambiguous police officer, you could read him as you know, a variety of ethnicities and races. There's nothing racial about this ad. Nothing about that at all. He's just an American, I think, is the way to put it.
He played
and
football.
He just loves his country.
He always has, ever since 9/11 when he learned what it was.
Yeah, that's right. As he sees protesters light a flag ablaze, he like has this series of flashbacks to when he was when he was having his badge pinned on his chest, yeah, graduating police academy, when he watched a fallen comrade being carried off a plane. He was there with his fellow troops, saluting proudly, and then flashing further back to when he gazed up on that flag as he stood at attention as a football player,
yes,
on the high school football field, just, you know, paying homage to old glory. And then, yes, we got a flashback to when he's a kid watching a restaging of the firefighters raising the flag in front of the World Trade Center,
yeah,
because methinks Grunt Style did not actually get the rights to use the original footage. So they sort of recreate that famous moment. And then we flashback forward to this cop as Antifa comes streaming over the barricades. And he gives this little smirk. And then this is my favorite part of this thing.
Yeah.
He shoots his arms out to the side like Wolverine in the X-Men movies.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a sound effect with it. It makes like a little shunk sound. Mm-hmm. Now you might think, are cops Wolverine? The answer is no. however.
Is it they don't have the healing factor? What's the... They're not from Canada? There's cops in Canada.
They don't have the good facial hair, frankly.
Yeah, okay, fair.
That's very true. But with a little movie magic.
Yeah.
With a little movie magic, you can make a cop sort of like Wolverine by, apparently, it looks to me like they digitally remove this asshole's right arm. And then they have it spring into existence as he unfurls his arms with a nightstick in hand.
Maybe it's an extent.
He is just...
Maybe it's like a... You're suggesting that like Wolverine's claws, he just has a nightstick like locked and loaded in the forearm, ready to go.
It shoots out, not... So it shoots down, not out.
You're right. Saying you so see
there is
it.
No flexion. It is just, yeah, a shooting it just, out.
It does, right. Just
Danielle, is there any way he could have been holding that arm in that video where you would not have seen his arm a minute before, and then it appears, yeah, with it a nightstick in it? I don't think there is.
So there's that, flexion usually. Look at the shoulder. Typically, okay, you're seeing flexion
back
with
the
shoulder.
This is what I'm saying. So anyway, he shoots his baton claw out. And you know it's time. Like, he's ready to do battle with Antifa.
Right.
And then it ends with, gosh, what is it? Some things we defend.
This will defend.
This will defend.
Yeah.
This will defend, Grunt Style. And then it's a pair of cross rivals. Now, sadly, seconds after that commercial ended, that police officer was eaten by Gritty. So
we can't have him on today, but
no, we should have a moment of respectful silence for that brave hero.
For Gritty's meal.
Yeah, I mean, Gritty, I mean, look, you know, let's spare a thought for Gritty too.
Hey, real quick.
He's got to pass that nightstick.
He's big. We don't even feel
he'll be
it.
Okay.
This will defend is like a real thing from the army.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Can they just do, I guess they can, fuck it. All right, I'm not, you know what? I'll let the army handle the army's business. If the army wants to go after Grunt Style, they should do that, I guess. I'm not here to defend them. That commercial was a lot because it was so brazen, I think, is part of the thing, right? Like,
yeah,
part of what we talk about, and I think part of the piece that, that you've linked us to here about Face by Nate Powell, what it gets at is like, oh, some of this stuff can be very subtle. Like, One of the things that Nate Powell pulls out very early is that things like the universal kind of military haircut, the uniform standards, some of that stuff is connected to like particular international regulations. Some of it is tied to rules that are as part of the Geneva Convention about separating out what a soldier looks like versus what a civilian looks like. And that stuff all functions in a very quiet way, in a way to help produce a vision of what soldiers look like, and therefore also those then kind of funnel into a vision of what patriotism or nationalism or nationality even looks like. But this commercial is not that. And kind of what Nate Powell is trying to get at in this piece is that we're also at this moment where it's becoming the kind of symbols at play are bigger and bolder and have like stepped out from the shadows a little bit, but are also tied to a long history. That or that they are actively tying themselves to a long specific history of fashion and style and national identity and white supremacy specifically.
And I think something else that Powell is unpacking in this essay, and I think this is probably the most convincing part of the essay. Like this mm-hmm. essay has three distinct arguments it's making. I do not think they are all equally strong or equally thought out, and I'm not sure. Like it's a compelling essay. On further examination, I think the form of the message mm-hmm. can cover over some of the places where the connective tissue of the essay is maybe a little more elided. But where this is probably at its most convincing is where he lays out the fact that in the armed forces, certainly prior to the War on Terror, definitely prior to the 90s, you have slightly tighter standards on military appearance and military dress. And part of that is because there is just more pressure to conform to these like international standards of what combat personnel should look like. The flip side of this was that when soldiers were not on duty or were not in an active, not on active deployment, they also had a little more freedom or would choose to exercise a little more freedom in Powell's telling as to what they were wearing. And a couple things happened. One is that now basically military personnel are always wearing fatigues. Like even if you're doing a job in the Pentagon, a lot of people are still just showing up to work in, fatigues and boots as if they're in a forward deployment area. And second, and this is probably the more important thing, there's kind of this aesthetic mimicry that starts happening of special forces troops.
Right.
Special forces troops were exempted from a lot of these uniform codes because, again, the easiest example is it is easier to blend in with a civilian populace in, say, the Middle East or North Africa if you are, a dude with longer hair and a beard. Right. Like that's probably a more effective costume in some ways for you. Like there's more ways to dress up and sort of blend in if you have that appearance than if you are somebody with like, a really clean shave and, running around in a standard, easily identifiable uniform. And that aesthetic starts getting co-opted first by regular army personnel, but then it makes its way out to private military contractors. And that seems to be sort of the move, the shift that Powell identifies as kind of being where all hell breaks loose, right? And his argument is that...
Can you describe the look really quick, actually? Because I think it's an important distinction to be like... Partially because I think when I say U.S. soldier, I don't know what comes into people's minds at this point because... this vision, this image has shifted so much. If I'd said that in the mid-80s, I suspect a very particular image would have come to mind for listeners on the podcast when we were doing it back in the 80s. But now, in 2019...
I've got the perfect example. I know exactly.
Fred Bradley Cooper?
Here is the image. Tier one operator.
Yeah.
Right. In so Medal of Honor 2010.
Yeah, totally.
That you're 100%.
That big bearded dude.
Yeah, like who gets promoted... In it's the who was involved in the killing of Osama bin Laden. Like those are the soldiers that get sort of propagated in our like popular culture imagery far more than the more uniformed sense that you know, Austin is mentioning is harkening back to the, you know, 70s and before.
So it's like backward baseball cap, sunglasses, big beard, tattoos on the wrists or on the, like, it's a little bit more biker, a little bit less, like, classic.
Saving Private Ryan. Type.
There we go. That's a good touchstone.
Was Bradley Cooper in that Clint Eastwood movie? Sniper movie. What is the name of that?
American Sniper.
Yeah, yes. Sorry.
That is even the specific
connection. It's even in there. Yeah, sorry.
That Powell makes, right? Yeah. Totally. Yeah. I forget where you were going when I interrupted you. I'm sorry.
No, I mean, no. And so...
Oh, the...
There's...
Sorry, continue. I thought I remembered where you were going, but I don't.
So sort of that mimicry makes its way out to, from regular army, out to private military contractors. And those guys all start styling themselves as if they are like elite special forces. As the record amply shows, they are not.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing that Powell brings up is that in investigations into the conduct of the war in Afghanistan, according to Powell, Afghan villagers also noted connections between the conduct American troops showed toward them, and they drew a distinction between ones who looked a little bit more like, you know, your typical classic American soldier, and then people showing up in this more like special forces aesthetic, right? The bearded, sunglasses wearing American troop tended to be more likely to perpetuate violence against Afghan civilians. And that was an interesting argument from Powell. And he points out that, you know, when you're wearing a full beard and sunglasses, you're kind of hard to identify.
Yeah.
That's going to cover up a lot of identifying features. And part of that entire look then becomes also about not only being able to blend in, but also it becomes about being able to mask your identity without like overtly concealing it.
Right. You're not wearing a mask, which would call attention to you and therefore let people know that you're dangerous, or kind of separate you from the so-called forces of order, which have a monopolization on quote unquote legitimate force, right? Like, you are still wearing your uniform. You are not doing something that the people you report to tell you you're not allowed to do, and therefore you're acting within your rights. And so you're not someone anyone can get on the phone and be like, hey, I think I see a weird person here. That can't happen because you're not in the codification of what weird looks like or dangerous looks like. You are an acceptable type. Unlike, for instance, the people who might be on the phone saying, hey, someone dangerous is here for sometimes similar looking features.
Right.
Like beards.
Right. Well, I think that's very much like this. If there's a through line connecting Powell's argument here, it is that a lot of this aesthetic is about implying the possibility of violence without openly declaring intent. Right. It's about creating this sort of space of uncertainty around your appearance and your intentions and your actions that this aesthetic both encourages, but also as it's being brought home, also implies things about how we relate to one another. That are scary, that are deeply troubling about people sort of adopting this aesthetic. And I think that's probably the central thrust of this argument.
And it was interesting to watch the different symbols he brings up. Mm-hmm. My conception of, like, for example, like the Punisher as a character from Marvel Comics is very much more or less rooted in the end state of how it's been co-opted by, like, a lot of this paramilitary imagery in which, like, oh, like, before I, like, read up on the character, and it's put in a stark, it's nicely contrasted in this image essay where the author breaks down the origins of the Punisher as, like, reflective of an attitude in the late 70s as troops are coming back from Vietnam and the way they were treated. And this is a sort of a character that's not just about, like, going around just killing people because, like, I'm a fucking vigilante and, like, I'm just going to go do what needs to be done. Like, it's a much more complicated, nuanced character in which it was set up as sort of how you viewed the character was a reflection on, like, how you viewed society and, like, your role in society. And yet, that is absolutely not the way that I constantly see the Punisher imagery used in real life, online. Like, it is so commonly associated with, like, I'm a badass, and I like gun. Like, there's just a different way that character, and not even the character, right? Like, the character maybe to some extent, but largely just the image of the skull and what that conveys. As someone that had not really done the research on that character, other than just, like, cultural osmosis, it was, like, really shocking to like, realize, like, the actual layered complexity to that character, and it really put the whole essay into focus, and, like, when it was picking out those little bits, like, the Punisher one is what just stuck out to me, because, like, that's, like, one that was very, not that I'm very identified with the character, but just one, like, oh, I thought I knew who that character was. Like, fucking nope. Like, and I found that to be, like, a really interesting, like, way in to understand some of the other icons that the essay pulls from.
There are a couple of things here that are very, very interesting. One of which is the just inherent tension of the sort of militarization of police that it actually happened, not just in terms of symbology or, you know, the way things look or the way style is, but post 9/11, a lot of police departments obviously received a fuckload of funding for bigger toys, better toys, more, you know, military-esque toys to play with, basically. And that has obviously not been a great thing. And when I was at the ACLU, I did a little bit of work on, not that I did the work, I'm not a lawyer, obviously, but I did communications work on a lot of these sorts of cases, like FOIA requests for, okay, how did you pay for all of this? It's small town police department having, like, you know, again, these are seen as sort of toys for boys.
People shit.
Yeah, right? Like, it's seen in a lot of ways. And even in this essay specifically, it talks about this being like, boys will be boys. You know, these are toys for boys. This is a way of expressing masculinity as well as whiteness. Like, there's two levels of this, of course, here. One is the whiteness and Americanness.
Like this
we've got three levels here.
Yeah.
We've got the Americanness, we've got the whiteness, and we've got the masculinity. And throughout this essay, it's very, very sort of clear to me that there's no room for women here at all in this ideology, right? I mean, I suppose there is some room for, like, the prototypical, like, the woman who wants to be a masculine badass, I suppose, or who supports this.
You can always
this.
Be a Spartan mother.
Right. The Spartan mother, the wife, the good wife.
Right, the reproductive.
Who does too for her man, you know, that kind of thing. But that struck me as being very, very, very sort of in keeping with this whole, like, this is just toxic masculinity. Just drink it down. This is like Gatorade for toxic masculinity in a lot of ways.
Yeah, definitely. I think that, like, there are times this essay needs another 20 pages if it wants to dig into what it's trying to do. I think, like, specifically the Mohawk, where it's like the Mohicans and also Strangler's 300 Spartans, and then Travis Bickle is there, and it's like
Mohicans,
all right,
are different tribe, by the way.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
The vampire thing too. Mm-hmm. The vampire thing was also kind of like, this is interesting, but what's the thread?
Totally. Wait, like, can we bring it together? So I think there are times, there are moments where I'm like, I wish he would have more space to build on this, or had just cut some of these things and focused in on what works. For me, the thing that worked the best, or the thing that stuck with me, was this section pretty early on where he's talking about the slow return of facial hair and the Forever War and the ways in which there is the production of a faux innocence.
Yeah.
I'm just going to read from it because I think it's really strong. He says, the subtle return of troops' facial hair banned for a century to accommodate airtight gas masks in an age of chemical warfare has helped to imply a circular relationship to the history in which a society's conflicts are inescapable echoes of a historical precedent, a national myth alike. By seeing troops resemble their predecessors from the Civil War or Spanish-American War roaming a similar arid landscape, it's easier to conflate these campaigns as chapters in a mythical centuries-old forever war. This eternity narrative weaves together both Old West revisionism and lost cause fantasies, asserting a narrative of eternal innocence, of nobility to provide some meaning to years and lives destroyed fighting someone else's wars. And with eternal innocence, now is then, steamrolling our capacity to process, learn, and grow from history. The line he's drawing here is that, like, this image of, like, the bearded, lone, you know, tier one operator, the Wild West gunslinger.
Wolverine.
Absolutely.
Literally Wolverine, in, like, the credits to
absolutely
that.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Wolverine. Yeah, you're 100% right. Is this sort of, like, recurring figure in the stories we tell about imperial wars that America has been a part of, about colonization efforts that Americans have been a part of. And you see it bubble up. We saw it bubble up with Red Dead Redemption last year. We see it told all the time, in which you take the figure of this like exceptionally gifted soldier, badass, and you place them, despite the fact that they are the purveyors of violence and the thieves of land and the killers of the innocent, as themselves just a cog in the machine of the imperial body, of the colonial project, not as actors, and in fact, as almost victims of it. Oh, they're innocent. They've been taken advantage of. The generals of the South. Now, let me tell you, those are honorable men who believed in family and country. Some of them were even abolitionists in their heart. But blah 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 blah. And that same argument is trotted out again and again, often for this particular model of masculinity and men who are heralded as heroes. Like, for me, these are the same arguments that get brought out when a few years ago we were in the middle of talking about statues of Confederate generals, right? The types of masculinity that when you point to a statue of Robert E. Lee that you're trying to defend is something that's supposed to be ahistorical, universal, that's something that's supposed to have existed forever, and that has in the argument the person, whether explicitly or implicitly, says there is good and there is bad and those are ahistorical things. This man is a good man. He was just fighting for the wrong side in this moment of history. And once you've ceded that, like, you've lost the argument in general, because then you've given the person who's making that argument the ability to make claims about universality and about what is basically whatever claims they want, because they can ground them in a way that doesn't have to deal with actual material repercussions for people. And so for me, that little section is like where it is the most productive for the way I think about history and war and the way we draw our heroes very literally, you know?
Yeah, and one part I wish that maybe it expanded on a little, because it definitely struck me in a couple of panels, was like it touches on the idea of like generational iconography and the way that parents use iconography to imprint identities onto children, in that when iconography becomes identity, it is, and we've all experienced this in different ways, like it is incredibly difficult to remove that from yourself. Like, that can be a lifetime's worth of like removing yourself from what you were told a thing means. And like that, I mean, it's a general through line through the whole piece, but like there are bits and pieces in the essay where there are flashes of parents like, you know, passing on this stuff to their kids, in which it's like on some level, you know, the parent is doing this on purpose in order to make like this an identity that the child will live with for until they're able to untangle it, or if they ever choose to untangle it themselves. But even then, that was passed to them from someone else. Right. Like, it is a powerful force that is passed from generation to generation on purpose, because once iconography is identity, like, it is extremely difficult to untangle the two. And I mean, that's related to the Confederate flags, like in the monuments, but like that's like a huge through line here, where like once you pass that around through a generation and it's given to you from a young age, you know, it's propaganda. And propaganda is just incredibly hard to untangle from your mind. It takes a lot of work to do so.
Yeah, I think for me, one of the things I also found really useful here was just the description of what is uniquely appealing to some degree about the use of the Punisher symbol itself. There's a passage here where Paul writes, "The death's head is plausibly deniable in relation to American fascist symbology, despite its explicit use as a Totenkopf, because of its wild popularity in pop culture and style. Its power lay in its apolitical mass appeal. Cool stuff to buy while functioning to normalize a paramilitary proto-fascist presence." I was just going to say, that's for me, that's the other part of this. Like, Austin, what you're talking about is like people beginning to pin down, like, what does this symbol mean? What are you appealing to here?
Yeah.
And removing the ambiguity around that. Look, there's nothing universal here. So Robert E. Lee is not something we can just like, he's no longer the secular saint of American military tradition. He never was, but he certainly isn't now. That's not a tenable position anymore. So if you're flying, like, you know, the Confederate flag, and a lot of people are still perfectly fine to do that. But nevertheless, you are explicitly declaring something with that, that like you are going to be called on. The Punisher thing, is useful because basically it allows you to play with like famous fascist symbology, but it's also just the Punisher logo. Like, you know, pay no attention to the fact.
Don't take it so seriously, bro. Yeah. Like, it's a comic book.
It's a comic. Yeah, it's on Netflix, bro.
Right. Right.
It got canceled, so but it was good. And I've not seen the Netflix Punisher.
The first season was actually really good.
That's what I've heard.
I actually thought it was fairly nuanced and interesting. So, yeah. But yeah.
Wasn't bad.
Yeah, I've liked it. And the actor who portrays the Punisher, I forgot his name, and I apologize.
Oh, I thought you meant the character's name was Frank Castle. What's the actor's name?
It's John.
John Bernthal, I think.
Okay.
He is, at least I have heard anecdotally that he is very, like, he has gotten, like, really pissed when cops who have like, done some bad shit and been like, yeah, Punisher, he's been like, fuck you, I want no part of this.
But also, like, on the press tour, he was like, mad love for the troops. Just, you know, it's so,
I mean,
I'm sensitive to the fact that, like, the Punisher's a very important character to the troops. And so I'm
it's not like he's, like, pulling apart with that. Like,
yeah, of course.
Yes, the Punisher is a character that is meant to identify with, you know, people of military service, but like a very specific, in a very specific way.
The yellow ribbon.
Not just like he's good with a gun and takes out the bad guys.
Yeah, he wants to be the yellow ribbon dude who's like, support our troops. Yeah. But
he puts the yellow ribbon right into his bleeding heart.
Right there.
You know,
but he shies away from the blue stripe down the flag
down
kind
the flag.
Of stuff. He's not into the blue lives matter.
I really wish that a little bit more time had gone into unpacking that for readers who did not understand that. There's like a good section on the kind of hyper-masculinized, like, it's wild to even think about the idea of, like, I just like picturing it like a Stella skit. You know what I mean? You know, Stella, like Michael... like Michael Showalter, Michael Showalter, Michael Ian Black, and who is the third one? They're great comics who were also part of Wet Hot American Summer. Like, anyway,
I know what you mean now. Sorry.
In a fucking
different
board,
Stella.
People listening will know who I'm talking about. In a boardroom with a whiteboard, being like, "How do we make the American flag more masculine?" And just like all in suits. And the solution that has happened for real is remove all of the color from it, except for a pale blue line down the middle of one of the stripes, representing, of course, the blue line of the police who protect us and who serve us, you know? And I wish there'd been a little bit more detail on that, on how that practice happened. Like, I don't know who first made that flag, and I'm curious. And I'm curious mostly, did it come from law enforcement directly, or did it come from commercial, like, venture who recognized an opportunity and was like, I know what to do?
It's a very good question, but and this is one of the complexities for me of this. Is that I work with so many people on my ambulance, in my ambulance corps. There's so many sort of first responders who are very into this idea. They are very into this symbology. They are very into Blue Lives Matter. They share memes all the time on like our private Facebook page for my ambulance corps. And it's infuriating and troubling and something I see every day from people that I don't know what to think about it. It's one of those. It's really, really troubling.
Like, look, the undeniably, the thing is, there are traits that will cause the same person who is attracted to authoritarianism and fascism to also be attracted to public service and like first response work. Like there are things that both of the like that ideology and that kind of work will appeal to, and the same person who is absolutely the person you want to see showing up, like walking through the door on like a really terrible day for you and your family, could also be somebody you absolutely don't want to see at the door in another context. Right. Like, so it doesn't surprise me that there's that overlap. I do, however, man, people who like get really behind this shit, like this is the thing that really disturbed me about that ad. People who really do get behind this idea of like viewing the police as a persecuted population that must be protected, who really get like fucking misty eyed about like people calling the police fascists, and like who would watch that like grunt style ad and be like, damn, like, thank you, troop cop. For being that thin blue line. Like, people get fucking misty about that shit. It just makes my skin crawl.
I mean, it comes from a very particular, belief about what the state of the world is and state of nature, that like, if not for Troop Cop, all of our doors would be being kicked in. We'd all be being robbed and murdered constantly.
Yeah.
You can't trust anyone out there, especially those people. And
everyone's a perp.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Right. Which is a produced and taught belief about the world. It doesn't come from a vacuum. Like, this is part of a long history of entertainment media, of schooling, of, you know, faith.
Well, and also there's police secular consultants and trainers.
Totally. Totally.
Who like go around the country. Like Radley, yes, Balco, like wrote stories about, well, he literally wrote a book about police militarization, yeah, but also like small town police departments also hire consultants to go around the country and impart the same ideology. Like, yeah, they show up saying like, I'm going to teach you to be a more effective officer. But in addition to that, what being a more effective officer frequently means is like how to fuck somebody up in close quarters combat. And then the other thing they're teaching is you're not just a cop, you're a street warrior. You know what I mean? You're a superhero. And so that's the other thing that I think there's always been a strain of this in like American policing, but I think probably in the last 25 years, 20, 30 years, it's become kind of an ideology that has spread almost virally in terms of like training methods adopted. I mean, this goes back to that piece that got run aside him twice in this episode, Duncan Fife wrote about Daryl Gates.
Yeah.
About, you know, the template he laid down for a hyper-militarized Los Angeles Police Department in the 60s and 70s became a model for American policing across the country, and still kind of is. And then gasoline was poured on that by, post 9/11 procurement budgets.
If you have not read that piece, it is How Sierra and a Disgraced Cop Made the Most Reactionary Game of the 90s by Duncan Fife over on Waypoint. Definitely go give that a read, because it is a fantastic look at how how Gates, one, produced an image of Los Angeles that was a kind of a lawless Mad Max vision of the world that would allow him to be justified in the brutal policing methods that he advocated for, taught, and allowed to happen under his watch. And then, after finally kind of being pushed off the throne, he went to work with Sierra to make a Police Quest game that doubled down, because there it was the world of fiction. He could build whatever fucking world he wanted to. And that just played all the way into that. It's a great piece by Duncan, and one of my favorite pieces I think we published in terms of just like deep dives into shit I didn't fucking know about.
Might be my favorite piece we've ever put on the site.
Totally, totally. Also, I'll note I did some Googling around, and it looked like a lot of major flag companies started selling the thin blue line flags in like 2014. But when they, of course, blew up was like, yeah, so it's Black Lives Matter and it's marches, right? Like, it's specific, yeah, marches from Black Lives Matter. It's counter protesters after police kill black people. Mm-hmm. And the counter protesters needed something to wave. And so what they had were thin blue line flags. Obviously, the term goes back way before that. But in terms of like, we sold a bunch of these this year, 2014, 2015, 2016 seemed to be the big years.
And they're probably profitable.
Oh,
that's,
yeah,
the really fucking sad thing. Like, mm-hmm, I can imagine maybe that was a chunk, I am guessing, mm-hmm, but given again the view I have on the kind of folks who enjoy this sort of thing, I imagine they sure are buying those flags.
Thin blue line, 20% off St. Patrick's Day code.
Oh my fucking god!
Mm-hmm. Okay. So when you're pulled over on St. Patty's Day, a cop will know this guy's all right.
Got this for 20%
off. 20% off,
bro.
All right. We're going to take a quick break and hopefully not try to sell you anything from Grunt Style.
Who could say? Algorithmic. It's programmatic. Who knows? My understanding is we run ads for the British military. And I was like, don't do that. And the response I got was not helpful, is what I will say.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Shh.
Shunk. We're back.
Shunk. Wow.
All right. Our next waypoint is from the magazine Heterotopias. And it is a piece
My
called
favorite
Six
magazine.
Cities.
Just kidding. Sorry.
Is it not your favorite magazine?
No, it is. Wow. It's a joke on Venus.
Did you promote it and then drag it?
It's a joke on gayness. Wow. Hetero. Fine.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Fine. Mm-hmm. I should have developed that better. I should have said Gaytopia. This is my favorite. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Rob, continue. I apologize.
It's your waypoint, man. You can do whatever you want to it.
Okay.
But the piece is Six Cities. It is written by Maria Bonate Escoto. Yes. And it is a piece about one of my favorite games, Dishonored. Danielle, want to tell the people what this article is about?
Yes. And in case you didn't know, Heterotopias, which is amazing, and I'm sorry I tried to make a very terrible joke. I'm really on a fucking roll today with my jokes. Is a magazine about architecture and space and place in video games. Really, really awesome. If you're interested, I think there's like a Heterotopia. We'll find the website, whatever, it's fine. You can buy it. It's wonderful. Great work. This piece is about Dunwall and Karnaca, the two sort of main cities in the Dishonored games, and the way in which both they both show a sort of sickness, they show a type of decay and the way sort of human bodies can decay, and also talk about slow violence and the idea of environmental destruction and decay and also sickness sort of through human intervention, especially through powerful humans who, you know, people who oppress others, make them do dirty work, and in doing so, ruin the environment in a lot of ways. I loved this piece. I thought it made a great case for these concepts in the games and kind of goes through the games. It kind of goes through both mechanics and also environmental design. But also in that I love the Dishonored games. I'm a huge fan. We all know this. But I never actually finished the first one because of how disgusting I found the place itself, how disgusting I found Dunwall. It really upset me not visceral, that's not
no,
the right
but
term, but
mean.
Like,
no, that's,
in a like...
That might be a proper use of visceral.
This might be right, you know? The one use of visceral we can use today. Partially because I knew a little bit about whaling. Growing up in New England, I used to go to whaling museums. This is my family's idea of a great time, was like, let's take our little girls to this whaling museum, which was fairly sanitized, to be honest. You know, places like New Bedford, Rob, I'm sure you know, a lot of places like that.
I know all the whaling spots.
Yeah, you knew a little bit about it, right? Captain Rob, Admiral Rob, I understand. And it always has...
You know, Danielle, when it's a dark and dreary November in my soul...
Shout-outs to Mark. Shout-outs to Nathaniel Philbrick, actually, his book, In the Heart of the Sea, for telling me a lot more about whaling as an adult. Later on in life, I read that book. It's about, of course, the sort of progenitor story to Moby Dick about a whaling ship that was sort of attacked by the whale it was going to kill. Whaling is a truly grisly, disgusting, smelly, gross, horrible, cruel business. And much of this sort of industry in especially Dunwall is based on whaling, and you see a lot of it, and you eat things like potted whale meat that may or may not be tainted in the game, like through the actual gameplay. You see whales, you see whaling ships, you see all this really nasty, disgusting business, and it is a business. It is the business that the city runs on, is this really gross, nasty, sort of terrible thing that keeps the oil lanterns burning, it keeps the new technology coming, it keeps all the cool things kind of going in the city itself. So it's like a really, really powerful, and maybe it's a little on the nose for a metaphor, but it is very powerful and very sort of effective, I think, in the sort of the storytelling of the games. The writer also talks about mining and sort of how the miners are oppressed in Karnaca. It goes into some sort of colonial notions and how Karnakans are sort of used and abused by their sort of powerful elites, and also does go into a little bit of the rat plague itself, which is the sort of very literal sickness that is affecting Dunwall in the first game, as again a sort of metaphor for the sickness of this industry and the ways in which people are ruining the place. The human intervention didn't just put up a city and a sustainable business. It is a nasty, grisly, exploitative business that the city runs on. So. Really cool piece. I don't know if other folks read it.
Yeah,
or,
I definitely read
okay,
it.
Cool.
I think we all read it. We all knew it was on the list.
Yeah, it's, right. I think it's the opening, the way she opens the piece is talking about an oil spill in Spain
yeah.
That was particularly disastrous. And then sort of like the punchline is that, you know, I believe the government sued the folks responsible for the oil spill. And it took something like 10 years for it to like wind its way to the courts and like come to a conclusion. And the conclusion was, I'm paraphrasing, but like, wow, that was a long time ago. Kind of hard to assign blame at this point. So let's just move on. And, you know, she uses that as a way. It's like when environmental disasters or like long term disasters are inflicted on a people or a region, the increased distance of time can make it functionally and practically difficult to assign blame and to understand what happens to a people in a place over time. And part of what Dishonored does especially well is showing that displacement, showing over time what environmental, what political decisions, how those intermingle, and the way games uniquely allow you to get a better sense of both the affliction and the responsibility that like occurs, because Dishonored is playing with similar sorts of things that are both like, you know, mining is something they're choosing to do, but then there are, sort of spill effects and consequences of the way that entire world is built, or at least that, you know, that one empire is built on whale oil. I think she's absolutely right. Like Dishonored is one of those games that I found myself more than not, even as someone, I like these types of games, but Dishonored is one of the ones that I would actually spend the time sort of like studying the environment in a way, because it seemed to communicate a lot about its people, even when the cutscenes themselves weren't necessarily always in service of that.
Yeah. I think part of the reason that Dishonored works in this way so well, and like honestly at like a fairly surface level, like it is easy to play Dishonored 1 and be like, man, fuck all this. Whereas, like, seriously, like, you go through the houses of the rich people who've not been affected by the rat plague, or who've only just recently, after years of benefiting from the oppression, things are finally starting to crumble around them. I think that's a strength of it, partially because of its dedication to building a very unique setting. The author of this piece notes that like sometimes people call it steampunk, but it doesn't really have the baggage that a lot of steampunk has in the same way, which is except for one particular thing, because I think we have been critics of steampunk in the past because of its faux apoliticism. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like dedication to like high adventure, and like it's just cool because it's Gears. Just put Gears on there and that looks really neat.
It's in love with itself.
Right, exactly. And it's in love with itself without any sort of critical reflection. It's not even in love at like what it's saying. It doesn't think it's saying anything except this looks good. Yeah. And Dishonored is not like that. Dishonored, from just like, again, without a deep dive, just the surface level, is like, this is industrialization. We are killing all of the whales. Like, people are dying in the streets. The market is broken, and those in power are helping it break us. But I do think there is one thing that I wish had come up here, and that this is, I think, maybe Rob, or you're talking about the second Duncan Fyfe piece that we're going to reference today, is he also wrote a piece for us 2 years ago now, 2016, called The Unsettling Political Power Fantasy of Dishonored 2, in which he gets into the player characters' complicity with all of this shit, right? Because this is a piece in which he kind of identifies, this is like being written right after Trump gets elected, obviously, so it's like I think where a lot of our headspace was. But the Emily Caldwin, who you play as, or you play as her father Corvo in Dishonored 2, you are the head of state, or you are deeply connected to the head of state, and have, you know, whatever reforms you may have done, you have not fixed the mining situation in Karnaca. You have not stopped the natural disasters that plague your land. You've not stopped all the whaling and the exploitation of natural resources. And the ending, like the good ending, as Fyfe identifies it, is basically the reestablishment of the royal family in power. And that's kind of it. It is not a world of revolution. It is not a world where we address what those deep problems are. You know, maybe you send some bad people to the gulag in the first game. And that's a specific way one quest can end, right?
The brothers.
The brothers, yeah, totally. But like, you're not enacting systemic change on the structure of society. It is a game that shows you all of that stuff, but it's not enabling you to change it, even though you are literally – the executive, and not just the executive, you're the executive of a what is effectively a monarchy. Like, I should have read more books in the game. I know there's an empress, but I actually don't know if she's like a real head of – she's a real head of state, right?
Yeah, I think is. So. Okay,
it's not like a – there's no like fake parliament. There's no like – okay.
I think she makes decisions. She makes decrees. This is all really actually fascinating to think about from this angle as I'm still listening to last week's Waypoint, the Revolutions podcast on the French Revolution. Episode 22 now, Rob. That's where I got into so far. But yeah, it is a really, really very cool thing to think about in terms of the sort of real world stuff that it's playing with, certainly, and maybe failing on that level.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think this was my one frustration with the piece is that I like the piece. It was a fun trip down memory lane of why I like Dishonored. The problem is that it also felt like it was just telling me what the game I played was. Like, this was kind of the thing I was running into with this piece is, like, if you had played Dishonored and you'd, like, paid attention to the journals you got, like, all of this stuff was pretty on, like, it was pretty upfront. The game wasn't concealing this from you. This wasn't a subtext to the game or something that was revealed only through, extensive exploration. This was pretty much what the game said up front were its major themes, right? The first game is about sort of the, almost the caustic moral effect that an extractive industry like whaling what was having on society, the way it was sort of breaking down bonds of empathy in the people who were most implicated in it, and how that sort of reflected a broader societal breakdown in empathy. The second game is very much about these tensions between, workers who labor in extractive industries, and then the owners who are always pushing for more, faster, looking to cut corners. All that stuff was kind of there up front in Dishonored. And I think what I would have liked this piece to dig into a little bit more, and this is why I liked the section on that environmental disaster in Spain, for instance, is either connected to more things outside of the game, or dig in a little bit more into what the game's conception of its political universe and the relationship between politics and economics actually is, right? What is implied? What is being implied behind this world they've constructed on the surface? That was the thing. It kind of felt like I was missing a little bit from the story.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's a very very fair and valid thing to feel about it, certainly. I was drawn in by the slow violence sort of aspect of it, the connection to environmental disaster, and also just environmental.
What that is for people who don't.
Who probably knows this a little better than me could definitely talk about slow violence. My understanding of slow violence is it is a term for what we're doing to Earth. It is a term for the fact that human intervention and the ways in which we go about doing our business as human beings is ruining our planet, even though we've been sort of specifically, adapted and designed to live on this planet. And now we are doing this slow violence on such a massive scale. Again, I am not an environmentalist,
of the oil spill. Like, what she illustrates is like the slow violence is okay. It wasn't as bad as it could have been, and like we've
only because of
it
timing,
up. Only because of timing,
right?
And it's like okay, we kind of cleaned it up, but like okay, it had an effect, and it's like we're just not going to know what that is because it's all retrospective. It's all hindsight. So it's like a slow violence occurs when, like, 15 years later, you go, ah, fuck, damn, like, those animals are just gone because of that spill, which wasn't as bad as it could have been. Well, could have been worse. Right. And so that occurs, part of it occurs in hindsight, right, as you understand that, like, it wasn't, a bomb going off, but, it is certainly left a mark. You just don't know what the marks are until much later.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And it's hard to identify when it's happening. I think that's the other part of this is that if you looked at – so when you come in Dishonored 2, and this is well laid out in the piece, you come to Karnaca in Dishonored 2. That place is messed up. Yeah. Like, that place clearly was beautiful. It is now pretty much a full-on hellscape.
Yep.
And that nobody would just be cool with – someone coming into their beautiful town, their beautiful community, and turning it into a hellscape, right? Like, people are like, hey, you mind if I just release these ravenous blood flies in that building, that building, that building? And then I'm just going to, like, just jet some silver dust into the air, just, like, really just breathe it in, just steepen it.
Hey,
like,
where should I put the sand? We got all this sand. Can we put the sand in here?
The concrete?
We're just
going to
dump it in this room. Is that okay? Cool. Bye.
Yeah, exactly. No, nobody would just let you do that. But the thing is, this stuff unfolds on a slow enough time scale that, like, first small things break down, first small things change, and then you sort of hit a tipping point and the changes happen very fast and things sort of fall off a cliff very, very quickly. That's the other part of this, is that if it happened all at once, we'd recognize it as what it is. It is violence. It is the destruction of a community and a way of life. It happens slowly enough that we don't notice, we don't know to call it violence a lot.
This is one of the things that I think is super interesting. I was getting to this point before and I didn't quite make it correctly. I didn't quite finish my thought, which is one of the reasons why I think Dishonored works is because the ways in which it shows these things feel novel in contrast to a lot of other immersive sims, sure. A lot of their games that are about dystopias, because those are tend to be using the iconography, the symbols of stories we've heard a million times, right? Like, I like Deus Ex. I like Deus Ex Human Revolution. That was the most recent. No, not the most recent. Most recent was Mankind Divided.
Mankind Divided.
Right.
But all of them generally use symbols I've read about in science fiction that I have seen already in you know, movies, on television, in anime. And I'm not saying that there is not a ground that there is not a collection. Dishonored doesn't have a bibliography. It absolutely does have a bibliography. It is absolutely pulling from things like The Difference Engine and some other, like, works in industrial fantasy from Perdita Station, from, like, a bunch of different particular books. I'm not saying it's not doing that. But when I first walked into one of those rooms that had the mosquitoes, when I first, like, walked into when I first, like, saw the rat plague move through the streets, it, with the speed that it did, and then was asked to embody that rat plague and think about in utilitarian terms, what does being part of this spreading, like, rodent disease look like at the – when I say systemic here, I don't mean – what I mean here is, like, at the infrastructural level or at the as a blip inside of this machine that is a connection of you know, pipes and gutters and everything else. How do things move through that system, almost like in a SimCity sense? It was very evocative and very striking in a way that, like, robot arms are not. And I like robot arms a great deal.
Yeah.
But they're never going to make me, like, halt in my tracks and be like, oh, like that. And Dishonored does that very often. I think this piece is a good job of, like, pulling those out very poetically. And, like you said, there's a nice walk down memory lane for me a little bit here. Of, like, you know what? Yeah, those were the images that helped. Things like the electrified walls, you know, like, stuff like that really does communicate something about a particular space. The irony there is that there's almost a tension, which is the examples of walking into the room and being like, oh, fuck, there's a bunch of giant mosquitoes in here. Is fast violence, like, in the world of this game, it's slow violence, right? Like, this stuff happened slowly, so slowly that nothing was done to halt it in a way that hid the damage being done to local communities. But in order to be effective, and I don't just mean this in a video gamey sense, but in order to be effective for you, the player, you have to be punched in the fucking gut by it most of the times. And I think there are probably some instances where you slowly start to understand what something is, maybe. But by and large, like, the ways that these games work is like, yo, I can't believe this is happening. Or, oh my God, did you see this thing? And that's just it. I'm not dismissing it. This is an interesting tension between those two. They're using quick symbols to talk about slow violence. And that's interesting.
Yeah, I think she kind of makes the point that, like, mechanically, you're doing a whole lot of killing people and stabbing and blipping out of into oblivion.
Yeah,
and
it's
kind of the
violence.
Art style that's almost doing – not art style, but environmental design and architecture.
I don't even
like
mean
that.
The literal violence. I mean the way that they deploy –
that iconography being immediate in your face.
Yeah, of course. Which is what art has to do sometimes. Like, that's its goal. Its goal is to be the translator for you, to show you what the historical cost has been.
Yeah.
And it's this very tension that troubles Duncan, right? Which is all of Dishonored 2 is Emily or Corvo, but, like, I played Emily. It's Emily going to Karnaca and be like, whoa, what? I had no idea. And so it's this, like,
I'm just an empress.
Like,
I'm a simple country empress.
Exactly. It's like, I had no idea that this city that was providing all the silver for the kingdom had turned into a strip-mined hellhole. Wow, shocking. And so I think the game does a decent job of handling that because your character's perspective is someone who's not been an effective ruler and only identifies emergencies when they're put before her.
Yeah.
Which is kind of the damning verdict that Duncan reaches in his essay on the sort of Corvo Emily regime. Anyway, it's a fun trip down memory lane. It's a good article in Heterotopias. It's also got a lot of just gorgeous Dishonored screenshots.
Yes.
Yeah. In sort of a troubling, decaying way. I
also want to shout out Yusef Cole's piece, Billy Lurk Was the Spirit of Justice in 2017, also on our site, which talks about a time in which Dishonored slid the camera away from nobility and at a character who was approaching things as a person who has to deal with what the fucking nobles get up to. It's a great piece and shows that the game designers are not neither ignorant nor ambivalent about these questions. Like, there's a good attempt to at least address some of that stuff.
It's also the best Dishonored game, probably. The most distilled.
It's my favorite one.
Death of the Outsider, just in case you're curious. So
good. Speaking of the struggles of everyday people far from the centers of power, far from the elite, Patrick, you had a quick shout-out thing you wanted to bring up this week.
Yeah, I just wanted to point people in its direction. I haven't watched the whole thing, and so I didn't feel comfortable making it a full waypoint. But there's as there is every 15 minutes, there's a new series on Netflix. and I was in between my pain medication induced haze. I was looking for something kind of light to watch, and like the blazoned upon is just a show called Losers, and I'm like, all right, well, my first thought was like, oh, it's like some kids in high school, you know, whatever. Like, I just was like, that's just one of a billion different shows. But actually, it's like it's a docuseries in which it examines the basic through line is people who in a moment in their life faced some moment of adversity and loss and not loss, but lost. And then what did that do to them? And like specifically, the through line is I think it's all athletes. The first episode is a boxer. The episode I want to pitch you on, and this is I mentioned it in a chat room, our Discord, being like, and no one has to watch it. It's fine, but like I put it out there because I was like, I know Rob would really enjoy this, and he specifically said like, not gonna have time, but like, thanks for the offer. And then earlier today, messages me with detailed breakdowns of this episode. If you watch the second episode, all these episodes I think are like 25 minutes long, so they're like a really eat digestible something you can do while you're literally digesting your lunch, is about Torki, is that how you pronounce Rob? In the UK, there's these, different soccer leagues / teams, clubs, I guess, clubs is the equivalent of teams, right? Like for
yeah the clubs.
And basically, there was a change.
We should get you into soccer. We should get you into soccer.
I'd like to.
We should get you. We should
all give me a team. In a scarf.
He looks so good in a scarf. Even in the outfit you're wearing right now. I think we should get all of us into Premier League soccer.
Yeah.
That's sold on right now, though.
I know.
Tell us about Torquay, the Torquay Football Club.
Please.
Well, they're bad. They're extremely bad. And there was a change made in terms of like the league structure, in which like you had to like basically you got into different tiers. And if you were in the bottom tier, if you were the very worst team, you were just kicked out.
This is a thing.
You're just gone. And so the Torquay United was like faced with a season in which they were very likely facing that they were going to be last. They're going to be kicked out. And you have to situation that this, it's just a random club in a random city, but it meant the world. Like, this is what the city did every Saturday afternoon. Like, there's an interview with like one of the mega fans who, kind of speaks for like the larger fan culture for this club. And like when they realized this prospect that if they lost, if they became in last place this year, they basically, once you get out of the club, players don't want to play. They're like, it's more than likely that it's going to go out of business. Like, it's just not going to be able to sustain itself if it can't actually be part of the proper organization. And so what the city did on Saturday afternoons was watch this club play. They were bad, but they didn't care that they were bad. It was their team.
Yeah.
And so like there was going to be like a sincere loss of identity. And this has been a pattern, I guess, throughout the UK, where once these things started being implemented, once you're no longer actually the proper organization, like the clubs just go away. Like, and then you have to find a new one. And so like a lot of these like smaller teams that couldn't attract a lot of talent couldn't bring in a lot of players. And so I thought going in the arc of this episode, because like there are so many little things I could talk about, and I just would just encourage people to watch it. The arc of what I thought this was going to be was, oh, this team is just going to go on fire for a season. And they're just going to get really good, get right up to the edge of like winning, I don't know, like some tournament, and then just like fall off the map. And it's like, oh, the lovable losers came so close. And then no. And it's like, no. They're just bad. They're extremely bad the whole season. And it comes down to the final game of the season where if they don't, and it's not if they don't need to win. At this point, they are now within, I think, Rob, it was like being allocated on a scoreboard of like how many goals they had scored.
Yeah, it's a bit like hockey.
Season.
Like you get 3 points in the league for winning a game. Like 2 for a tie, I think. But then they were going to tie with somebody at the end of the season, and then it would be decided just on goals scored across the season. So they ended up in a place where one goal gets them a lock.
Yeah, and I guess like the team they end up playing in their final season is an extremely good team that has nothing to play for except to just kind of fuck with these people. And like the stakes are like very clear, and it's just... It's wonderfully shot. It's wonderfully there's only like 3 or 4 characters like that they're interviewing, but they all have such personalities that and the I don't want to spoil where it goes, but the game itself has someone gets bit by a dog and continues to play is what I'll say.
Wow.
All
right, I'm gonna watch
it. It's just it's great. And the first episode, Danielle, you would specifically, I think, like the first episode. Yeah. It's about a boxer.
Awesome.
And it has its own fascinating arc. But like this, if you spend 25 minutes, even to watch the rest of the series, because I can't necessarily recommend it. It is just, it's a little slice of, or as Rob put it in our conversation, it seems like a piece of the Midwest that we found out in the UK that makes me want to find like my own lovable loser team. Because boy,
God,
they may not be cheering for winners, but damn, they seem like they're having a lot of fucking fun.
Yeah.
And there's just so, in a larger sense, like I like the premise of the show, which is like, yes, it's called Losers because it's to attract your attention, but the episodes themselves are not about like reveling in somebody's worst moment. It is actually about trying to sort of unearth like what is interesting about loss and like what does that also mean? Because it's not just, there are different concepts of what losing means. It's not just like a binary thing. And so I'm anxious to see how other episodes maybe play with that. And yeah, so it's Losers on Netflix. It's really good. At least watch the second episode.
Yeah,
my guess is it'll sell you like it did for me.
Nice. That episode is super cute. Highly
I'm gonna watch this. This
I need
all,
it.
I'm looking at the list of other episodes, and they all look really, really interesting.
Need this in my life.
Yeah. Austin, you're watching something else though, right?
I'm about to rewatch some. So you know, I'm in a Gundam mode right now. Like
no shit, really?
He's in a Gundam.
I'm in a big one right now. We talked about this on Monday show and how like it's more than usual right now. And
now it's in the news.
Oh my fucking God. I didn't even want to talk about
that. Should I not have done that? I'm sorry.
Oh boy.
No, we can talk about that for a second. That's not my waypoint and it's not my shout out.
my waypoint is Austin's feelings on Brian K. Vaughan writing a screenplay for a Gundam adaptation.
I don't trust they're allowed to do whatever they want.
I just want you to know, Austin.
I'm fine.
We need to just give Austin's posture. He closed his eyes.
Yeah.
He breathed out.
I'm gonna
he
be
thought
fine.
About it.
It's the 40th anniversary of Gundam. Gundam starts in 0079. That is the year in the fiction that it takes place.
0079.
It starts in 1979. So it's been here for 40 years. They tried to do a live action thing once that was a fucking disaster. So it's hard to want them to do another one.
Sure.
Brian K. Vaughan is a person whose comics I like. I don't know that I've ever liked anything he's done visually, like not in TV before. Actually, I don't know. Has he done movies, actually? Has he written movies?
No, he's mostly done.
I know TV stuff.
He got brought into television writing off of
Lost, right? Or off of Why the Last Man. But that was like during the Why the Last Man run that he was doing. Mm. When he was doing Why the Last Man. So not the run, it's his comic. But anyway. But like I don't love Lost. We've talked about that. And he did something on he was part of what do you call it, right? What do you call it? What's the show? Is he not part of Robots Wild West?
Westworld?
Westworld.
Oh.
I don't think so.
Okay. Robots Wild West.
Someone told
me
that today, and I was like, I didn't know that. And it turns out.
I wouldn't be surprised if he's, but I don't think, like, whereas on Lost, he was like one of the like regular episode writers from season 3 forward. I don't think he jumps in a lot of like sci-fi. He does a lot of like script punching up and stuff like that does a lot of sci-fi work. Yeah. So.
Anyway, so I
just wanted to needle leave that for a brief moment.
Yeah, it's fine. We'll see how that shakes out. I'm not too...
It probably won't get made because these get announced made. Like
if
every
it
couple
does,
of weeks.
It's going to be the Star Trek movie. Here's the thing. If that movie gets made, it's just going to be... It's not going to be like a big chunk of the Gundam story. It's going to be like a modern retelling of stuff that happens before the first episode of Gundam, in which there's like a kid on a motorcycle, like a hover motorcycle or a circle motorcycle.
It's the only genius level repeat offender in the Midwest.
That's exactly, well, except it's going to be the other way where he's a nerd instead of being like cool.
Genius level cool. Nerd on the Midwest.
That's exactly it. He's not going to get into a Gundam until minute 80. And that's fine.
Well, you got to pay the ticket to get the sequel, to get the budget.
That's exactly
to
what
do,
it's going
to
do it. Right. Yeah, I know. Anyway. What I do want to shout out is, so because I've been in this mode, I've been tweeting about Gundam a lot and I've been like putting out like screenshots that I've like, oh, wow, this is a really interesting moment. Or I linked out to the Origin comic recently, which you can just read online, by the way. Search my Twitter feed for a link to that. The thing I specifically want to shout out is a correction for myself, which I wasn't incorrect. Netflix was just fucking Hulu was just lying. Hulu had said that they were going to remove 08th MS Team, which is one of my like, here's a good starting point for Gundam. It's called Gundam 08th, 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 like the 08th division, 08th MS, the letters M, the letter S, which means mobile suit, team.
Master of Science.
Science from Hulu. One, they didn't remove it, so it's still there to watch if you have Hulu. Two, and here's the real deal. This is the shit I'm actually, this is my secret shout out. You could just watch it without a Hulu account if you go to Yahoo View, which is a thing I didn't know existed. So there's a site. There's a site called.
Are you snitching?
Only on companies.
Okay.
Yeah. No one listens to this. I'll whisper it. That way the company.
Make sure you go to Yahoo View on incognito.
That way no one sees. Because like real talk, the thing I'm about to say is you might be right. If like. 20,000 people right now went to watch this on Yahoo View. Someone might notice that Yahoo
Some web
View's
manager
still
sees their Amazon Web Services spiking. Like, what the fuck
what
is
the fuck?
Up? What?
That deal ended 3 years ago. So I have to. I'm just gonna keep fucking diving at this point. If you go to because.moe, M-O-E.
What?
You go to because.moe. It's an anime like streaming search engine thing. It's like one of those good sites where you're just like, hey, is this thing I want to watch online somewhere for me to watch legally, like not illegally, not searching.
Because.moe, it's one of those good sites.
It's one of those good sites. Put it on. If they put me, they're allowed. You know what? Go with God. I've done the sign of the cross. You put my name on this site, I'll live. As long as these people aren't terrible, please. You know what? Just
that was dangerous, Austin. I don't know.
Okay, I hope they're not terrible. It's a very simple site. They're not saying anything. It's just a site you can search for things. So you go to because.moe, you type in Gundam. Here's what I did.
Like Google.
Like Google. It's like Google for anime. Put that on the site. And it just says like, oh, did you want to watch Gundam Seed? And one, my answer is no. But if I did, it has link outs to where I could go do that. Like it has the Crunchyroll logo and then it has the VRVN Crunchyroll logo because that's where it's hosted right now. And so while I'm doing this, I notice a lot of logos I recognize. Crunchyroll, Hulu is there, Netflix is there because they have a Gundam show. There's the Funimation logo down here. And then there's this weird like purple and white Y. And I'm like, who the fuck is that? And it turns out it's Yahoo because years ago, Yahoo signed a deal with Hulu where, do you remember how you didn't used to have to pay for Hulu?
Yeah.
You still don't. You just have to go to Yahoo View to do that. Yahoo View is still an ad-supported Hulu with all of Hulu's stuff, or at least a great deal of it, that just lets you – it's just that. It's just the Hulu stuff, but on Yahoo, and it's ad-supported instead of you have to subscribe. So
– who knows about this?
Sorry, I meant to whisper. Pretend I whispered.
So do you like Gundams? Do you like ads?
Do you like ads? Here's the other thing. I watched it on Yahoo View. No ads played. So I don't know that they have ad inventory.
Oh, shit. Our sales team got... No, sorry.
Wow!
It's programmatic. It's programmatic. Gotta
cut that. Cut that.
Don't. Our sales team tries really hard, and they're getting better all the time. So my point is, one, Yahoo View exists, which is a thing I didn't know about. If you Google it, you'll find... If you search for it, you'll find...
I'm here.
Do you see what I'm talking about? Isn't it wild that it exists at all?
Clicking on The Passage, episode 8.
There you go. You know, if you want to go watch This Is Us right now,
and
you can do that.
And it just has the Hulu logo there.
Yeah, dude, it's wild. It says,
full episode, season 1, episode 8, Hulu. No, this is Yahoo View.
This is Yahoo View. It feels like someone on Yahoo was like, nah, just use my account. Just use my login.
Oh, no.
That's what it feels like.
You broke up with Yahoo years ago, and yet you can still use all
No, but we're still on good terms.
Password
we see each
still
other.
Works.
You know, yeah, password still works. You know, he said it was okay. He said it wasn't a big deal. So, you know, we still see each other around Thanksgiving anyway. It's weird. I know he's dating my brother, but, it was, you know, still lets me use the Hulu. So it's all good. People should go watch O8MS Team with one note really quick, which is you should watch the dub or content warning, because the first episode absolutely has a homophobic slur in it, as they are setting up a gross hyper-masculine unit that the main characters are not part of. It's like, this is how soldiers talk, and it's like, boom, slur, and it's like, yikes.
Gotcha.
That slur is not...
They're just there to be like the team in Predator, basically.
Yeah, but not even. Yeah. It's the literally team. Throwaway.
Just gonna get fucking murked.
It's I'm not defending the use of the slur there, to be clear. And the U.S., yeah. The English dub does not use the slur.
Okay.
It still says pansies, which is still communicating the same thing, which is like, man, fuck these rando soldiers. These guys fucking suck.
Yeah.
Not like my soldier cops. Not like my troop cop. O8MS Team is a really interesting, like, first step into the Gundam universe. It's low in, like, power level. It's about a group of... like soldiers who are in a jungle, it's like a Romeo and Juliet meets Vietnam story meets giant robots. That's like the meets on Gundam 08
MS
Team.
Well, if we can all watch it.
Everyone can watch it. And I also think it's not – I think some people responded like, this isn't the best one. Why aren't you telling people to go watch the best one? One, I think because it's a great way to judge what someone wants from something as broad as a 40-year-old franchise like Gundam that has dozens of incarnations. If you come back to me and go, hey, I want more hard-ass, real military shit, I can put you in one direction. And we go, hey, I really like that weird super science stuff, I can put you in a different direction. Two, it's bad in ways that a lot of Gundam is bad. And so it's a good test for if you can fucking handle it. If you get like 5 episodes in and you're like, hey, all these women are dope, but this show kind of mistreats them and undersells them. And like, I can live with it, but I wish they did better. Then you're good to watch Gundam. If you're like, no, it never gets this right, I'm mad at it. You know, it's going to keep fucking it up, and you're going to have to keep gritting your teeth and be like, man, I wish it has interesting women characters all the way through it. It just never does them justice, and it's so frustrating. Not never. Never is strong. 40 years. They do their women characters
occasionally
justice
sometimes. Occasionally
they get it right. Occasionally. But most of the time, yeah. So
I can Austin. Watch season 5, episode 7 of Gotham called Ace Chemicals.
Right now.
But you can't watch The Handmaid's Tale. So it's like,
well,
that's
a specific. That's
Hulu.
Oh, huh. Yeah. So maybe they're not. Maybe they're specific original programming. No, just their TV shit. Maybe
TV stuff and some licensed stuff. Still, there's a lot of shit, man. You want to watch season 20, episode 16 of Law and Order SVU?
Totally.
Facing Demons.
Trigun
Classic
is on here.
Episode.
SNL is on here. Modern Family is on here.
There's just an anime tab.
Yeah, dog. I'm on it right now.
It just says home comedy.
Anime. That's the third
sci-fi
one.
Sci-fi and fantasy.
The three
drama,
genres.
Action adventure, movies.
Movies.
Anime, second billing.
Also a good genre. Movies.
Movies. I love movies. Their most popular movie. What do you think their most popular movie is?
I saw it. I can't say it.
I don't know.
It's Yu-Gi-Oh! The movie.
Mm-hmm. So just people,
isn't that
just
an anime?
People are just anyway. Coming here to watch anime.
Yo! Right. Guess what their list of comedy movies has?
Patrick, this is very special.
Evil Bong 777. Yeah. I'm pulling it up now.
Yep.
Didn't know that was a one. Uh-huh. Where's mine?
Yours isn't on Where's here. Mine? You gotta get this on here. God, there's not a lot of movies on here. There's some documentaries. Future Baby. I don't know what that is.
Our thanks to Too Mellow for the track Slide Asleep off the album After Midnight.
There's
you can find that at TooMellowMakes.bandcamp.com.
There's a Mass Effect anime.
You can keep up with all of us at waypoint.vice.com. I'm Rob Zachney. You can find me on Twitter at Rob Zachney. You can find Austin on
Yahoo.
Patrick, Patrick, where can people find you?
Am I signing with my Yahoo account while I get more?
Danielle, where can people find you?
Your Yahoo account?
Danielle.
I use it for fantasy R-I. Football.
All right, that'll do it for this week's Waypoints. We hope you've enjoyed the break. Please be sure to rate and review us. Actually, you know what? After you hold off on rating and reviewing us next week episode, like, but just you know, make a little settle
what
more
if we
reminder.
Had a Hulu
rate
ad
and review
in the middle
us
of this
week.
Episode.
I think we're a 5-star cast, not for me to say. We'll be back again with Waypoint Radio on Friday. But you should also be sure and listen to our podcast. Be good and rewatch it. Where this week. File recovery, God willing. We're going to be revisiting the 1995 Pride and Prejudice miniseries starring Jennifer L. and Colin Firth. Hope you'll join us for that and join us again next week for Waypoints. But until then.
Yeah, let me be clear. The first
Yeah, don't just say like you're going to talk about the whole series.
Can you
liar?
Yeah. Can you give a little Many background parts. On what's happened on the recording? Because it's a whole ride.
Okay, so originally we were going to cover this miniseries, six-part miniseries. We were going to cover it in two episodes, episodes 1 through 3,
yeah.
Then 4 through 6. Problem is, Danielle, Natalie, and I talked for over 2 hours and had not gotten through episode 1. And then we were like, is this a fuck-up or is it an opportunity?
Right.
And we decided it's an opportunity.
I want everyone listening to internalize that. Is this a fuck up or is this an opportunity? Mm-hmm. You know?
Waypoint.
Yep. You know what? Is this a fuck up or is this an opportunity?
Yep.
Welcome to our new recording studio.
The plug is half in. Yes.
However, things that are unambiguous fuck ups, somebody deleted the file for that podcast off our media server overnight.
Yep. Not, so we're one working
not one of us.
Not one of us.
That was not a euphemism.
Clear.
That was not us like being like, we don't want to drag someone on the team. Someone on a different team did this. Is this right, Kato?
Yeah.
They did a fucksy upsy.
They did do that 100%. Mm-hmm.
But who knows? Could be an opportunity for us to re-record or something like that. Who knows? This episode's going to drop at some point. We're going to be going deep on this series. Hope you'll join us for it. In the meantime, do not give in to astonishment.
They have Meet the Press on here.
Oh, boy.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Yahoo!
David Gregory, you're bust.
Yeah.
See, now, if you're going to get into political shows, I think you got to start on Face the Nation.
Oh!
They don't have Face the Nation, unfortunately.
We did.
Yeah, but the zeros are boring. Come on.
Drop the zero.
All right, pick a time you like. Yeah,
where am I moving it? This way?
17.
Oh, 4.
17.
That seemed like a...
That was a full second different.
A bit of a delay, but...
But it was 17.
Yeah,
I
believe you. I believe you. And they were pretty much
Brooklyn
the same.
Brooklyn switches daylight savings time at 2 a.m. on Sunday, March 10th.
Oh, I'm so excited for that.
Is that the good one?
It's the bad one.
No, it's not.
It's the bad one.
It's the bad one.
No, we need more daylight.
Yeah, we get more daylight. We lose an hour of sleep.
We lose an hour of sleep.
It's nothing is worse.
Man, I ain't fucking yeah, not everyone has
kids,
anyway.
Okay? So for yeah, some so people, this
I'm
is a big deal.
I'm sorry. I'm saying for me, the minority in this equation, I am excited. Also, as a work from home person, like, give me that sweet, sweet sun for a little bit longer instead of 4:45 in the afternoon. It gets dark.
Patrick, we're in a
we
cube.
We don't see the sun.
We're in a cube. They put us in a cube.
Months. We don't see the sun in here.
Patrick, this is what I look like.
This is what we see.
This is what I see all day.
Did you pull that off the wall?
Yeah.
Yes.
No, this isn't up on the wall yet.
It's you know just what?
Standing
start
there.
Start sending me free snacks, and then we'll talk.
All right. We'll
you
get
can
you a
have
snack
literally
meal.
All just the snacks.
I don't
from the office.
Put them in a box. Jesus Christ. Live a little.
I'll get you some pineapple nom noms or whatever the fuck it was that Chris Remo loved
nature
all those
box.
Years ago.
Nature box.
I'll get you some nature box, kid. We'll get you on that budget.
Big Island pineapple.
There you go.
Get us sponsored by Nature Box.
Is that still around?
Free stuff train. Let's do it.
Is it?
Somewhere. Nature Box, MeUndies, new members, Casper, Bombas 50% socks. Off.
I liked that brief boom in subscription services that would just send you random shit.
Yeah.
And boxes it was like, shit. Surprise, here's some random shit we mm-hmm. bought from a surplus vendor. Yeah, that was good.
Those still exist. My friend does one of those, and then the garbage he gets in the mail is fascinating.
Oh, I fucking bet.
Bark Box for doggies.
Mm. Mm.
Bark Box.
Bark Box seemed like the real low ebb of that
remember
entire
Bark
idea.
Bark Box? That was fun.
Oh, mm. remember that. The good ads.
Bark Box!
All
that's
right.
one of our best ads. Okay.
All right.